Imagine that you're recruited to begin working in a job that you've always aspired to. You begin that job and almost immediately realize not only that the company you're working for is involved in illegal activities, but that the illegality reaches all the way to the top of the government. Do you remain silent, or is it time to blow the whistle? I'm John Kiriakou. Welcome to The Whistleblowers. South Africa's detailed investigation into high-level corruption started in 2016 when the Independent Public Prosecutor's Office published a report entitled State of Capture and strongly recommended that a full-scale inquiry follow. At the start of 2016, Bianca Goodson had been headhunted to lead the management division of a South African financial advisory firm called Trillion Capital. By the time Goodson left her job, just 3 months later, she was well aware that her employer was right in the center of the original state capture allegations. She also realized that what she knew about Trillion's relations with the influential Gupta brothers and state-owned enterprises in South Africa would be of enormous value to investigators. Trillion was owned by Salim Issa, a close associate of the powerful Gupta family. The Guptas had extensive business interests in South Africa and used their relationship with the former president, Jacob Zuma, and his family to secure shady government contracts and to exert influence on the workings of the government. Goodson realized that her company was winning highly lucrative government consulting work thanks to Issa's connections, but doing very little work to earn the massively inflated fees. What she knew could corroborate what other whistleblowers had reported to the public prosecutor and would deepen the public's understanding of how deep the rot went. Bianca did testify before the public prosecutor, whose report appeared in October of that year. In 2017, after the release of the so-called Gupta leaks, a large collection of emails to the South African media, Bianca stepped back into the fire and made an external disclosure by releasing a public statement with supporting documents. Her statement detailed how Trillion would secure government work, pass it on to internationally recognized companies, and then pocket half of the proceeds. Through this business model, the company raked in almost 600 million rand within a short space of time while barely lifting a finger. One particularly lucrative deal that fortunately never came to fruition would have seen Trillion earn the astronomical sum of 4.4 billion rand, that's about 255 million US dollars, in advisory fees for a consulting contract that the professional services firm McKinsey had with the state-owned energy company Eskom, effectively extracting resources from the South African state. The Trillion transactions are currently the subject of various fraud, corruption, and money laundering investigations and prosecutions in South Africa, to which Goodson's evidence and disclosures continue to make an important contribution. Bianca Goodson, welcome to the show. We're so happy to have you. Bianca, your whistleblowing seems to have happened in a short period of time, almost immediately after you started a new job. Take us back to that period. You've just begun this new position. You spend your first weeks and months easing into the job. And then what happened? What did you see?
And then somebody asked me to open up a bank account with a bank that doesn't really have a presence in South Africa. So the bank was called the Bank of Baroda. It was not the main transactional account of the entity that I was working for. And then in between all the papers, when I had to sign over the account, was a letter or an affidavit basically saying that I've opened this account with a 300 million rand overdraft facility, that I'm giving all the rights of that account over to someone else that I don't know. That was like the one warning flag. The other warning flag was the fact that this company that had just started, it was 3 months old, had secured work to the value of 10 billion South African rand. Now, in my limited understanding of companies, no company is that lucky. And it was work with the state, right? So it wasn't like private sector work or anything like that. It was work with the state. So 10 billion rand in 3 years. And I mean, there was everything in my head was just saying, this is not normal. This is just not average. So unfortunately, fortunately, I think in hindsight, I resigned. And I resigned based on suspicion at the time. And it was 18 months later that I publicly blew the whistle, because then it became clear to me through the work that our investigative journalists were doing in South Africa that this company that I worked for was embroiled in this really hectic ploy and elaborate money laundering scheme to basically steal money from the state. And that's why I blew the whistle. But yes, I only worked for 3 months and I resigned 3 months into my job. It's the shortest employment tenure I've ever had in my life.
So many of us who are whistleblowers struggle in the beginning. We think, should I say something? Should I wait for somebody else to say something? Should I say something anonymously to protect myself? Maybe I should hire an attorney. What was your thought process here?
All of those things, plus some more. All of those things. At the time I was married, so the first person I spoke to was my husband. And, you know, when the news articles would come out about this entity and these people that I was working with, I first went to my husband and I would say to him, look, I need to do something. I need to speak to someone about this. I think it may be that the information that I have could be useful. My husband at the time was absolutely adamant. He said, look, just put your head down and just move on with your life. Don't cause a scene. Just be grateful that you left, find another job, let's just move on. My husband, and that drama escalated to the fact that we actually had fights about it. When journalists would call me and he would see that a journalist had called me on my phone, or he would hear me onto the phone from, you know, because it was a private number, and then I'd find out that they were a journalist later. I mean, he started actually physically abusing me. You know, so that was with my husband. I spoke to my mother and my father. They just cried because they didn't know what to say. They pastors, so they just said, Bianca, we'll pray for you. I spoke to my pastors from the church, and the pastors in the church told me to not do anything. I spoke to numerous attorneys the one bit of advice that I got from one of the attorneys was actually quite funny now in hindsight. He suggested that I leave my computer in my car. And I drive my car to like a really dodgy place of town and allow my car to accidentally get broken into and my laptop stolen. I mean, we thought about all these options. The one option that we couldn't do at the time, though, was approach law enforcement agencies in South Africa, because the speculation at the time, which turned out to be true, was that law enforcement was captured. So that's we call it the NPA, which I think is the equivalent in America of the FBI. I couldn't go to any cops or police stations. I couldn't do anything like that. So eventually I got so tired of lawyers and people around me telling me that I should do nothing when I knew that I had to. So I threatened them, actually. I told them, I said, if you guys don't help me, and I said this to the organization that was helping me, it's an organization called Pluff. And I approached another organization called Corruption Watch. And I said, if you guys don't help me, I will do this on my own. I will create my own website. I will put my own data on my own website. I will do it myself. And eventually Pluff conceded. They didn't think it was the best decision for me. But it was one of the biggest data breakthroughs that we have in state capture, because after my whistleblowing, a lot more whistleblowers came forward. And our investigative journalists at the time were able to use the information that I made public together with other data leaks to start putting together this picture of what South Africa called state capture, where effectively our president at the time was looting the state with a network of people, and he was looting it through our SOEs. So it was important that I did it, but there was nobody who encouraged me to do it. Eventually, my mom did. My mom saw how it was killing me to sit with this information and to not do anything. And my mom eventually supported me, but it was under the thing of don't tell dad. Or just tell him when he needs to know, because dad will tell you not to do it. You know, It wasn't the best experience, John, unfortunately.
Less than a year after starting your job, you found yourself testifying before the public prosecutor and taking on some very powerful people. Were you worried about the fallout? As you were testifying, were you thinking about not only the rest of your career, but also about your personal safety?
I couldn't get away from that. At the time when I met the public protector, my daughter was 4 years old, I think, 4 or 3 years old. She was very young. I guess that's my point. And the public protector felt that I needed safety. The public protector wanted to get me a safe house. But because I was in the throes of a divorce, what my ex-husband had done is he then said that I put my daughter's life at risk because I was making myself a target. And by putting my daughter's life at risk and also my life at risk, I wasn't a fit mother. So while I was busy testifying and trying to expose the state capture, bizarrely, I wasn't afraid of these sort of big guys or these big guns that I was taking down. I was actually afraid of my ex-husband because he was threatening me with custody. So it was a very difficult fight at the time. I felt confident in the guys that I was implicating because I had data. I had a copy of my computer, and everything that I was saying and the allegations that I was making were all backed up by evidence. So I knew that the worst they could do was sort of tarnish my reputation and do a bit of a smear campaign, which they did. And that, it to me, didn't even come close in comparison to me having to defend that I was a good mother. People in the country were calling me a hero, but I was in family court trying to, you know, save my daughter. So it was a very difficult time.
After the release of the Gupta Leaks emails, you went public with even more documents proving crimes committed by Trillian. That took unusual courage. And frankly, it kept the story in the news to the point that even if the authorities wanted it to go away or wanted to cover it up, they couldn't. It was your second round of revelations that kept the pressure on the government to continue what turned out to be a deep criminal investigation. Was that your calculation?
Yeah, so look, it's just a personal thing. I'm a data geek. And what I loved about the information that I made public was that the metadata had all been preserved in the way that I made copies. I imaged my computer before I left Trillian. And what I knew I could do was explain to anyone who was reasonable and logical and who wanted to listen that at least my data wasn't fabricated. At least I can stand and say, yes, I was the author, or yes, I was the recipient. And that's where the Gupta Leaks failed a little bit, because of the way that it was sort of sourced. There wasn't somebody standing behind the data and saying, this is my testimony. So it was a bit calculated and it was a bit deliberate. It was also very deliberate that I put on a website without any restrictions. I didn't want, at the time, there were so many smear campaigns happening against people that are speaking against state capture. I didn't want anyone to say that I'm only allowing a few elite access to my data and so forth. I indiscriminately made it public to everyone, right? So that it could prevent those kind of smear campaigns coming that, you know, that I had a different agenda. So I could have been criticized and I could also be recognized for what I was trying to do. And I was prepared to take them in equal proportions.
Bianca, stay with us. We're speaking with South African whistleblower Bianca Goodson about financial corruption in South Africa. We have a lot more to ask her, but we're going to take a short break, so stay tuned.
Если находили московские телефоны или что, убивали в хлам.
Нацики отходили, просто заливали бензином с канистр, подпаливали и уходили. Люди очень боятся, чтобы сюда назад не вернулась Украина.
Детей можете отдельно собрать, сейчас закончу сладкая Розан.
Главный принцип, все, что собирают люди в России, донести непосредственно в руки нуждающимся здесь, на территории Донбасса.
Welcome back to The Whistleblowers. I'm John Kiriakou. We're speaking with South African whistleblower Bianca Goodson. Good to have you with us, Bianca. Bianca, the impact of your revelations can't be understated in South Africa. You exposed one of the biggest financial scandals in the country's history. You did it virtually single-handedly. You did it at great cost to yourself and your family. Tell us what the government has done in response to your whistleblowing that might ensure that corruption like this doesn't happen again.
Well, there's two hats to wear in that regard. I mean, there's sort of the personal hat. So let me start with that because it's a bit easier. Regrettably, the legislation in our country and the leaders in our country haven't really done much to support nor protect whistleblowers. So from that perspective, I mean, there's a lot of statements that have been made. You know, so our president said, yeah, whistleblowers must be protected and stuff. But nothing's really happened in that regard. And that part's been very, very unfortunate. However, from a judicial perspective, there has been some progress. So with all the revelations of state capture, what had happened was there was a presidential commission that was put in place. People commonly call it the Zondo Commission, but the correct name is the State Capture Commission of Inquiry. And that ran for about 3 years. And it was a really detailed investigation into all the allegations of state capture. And the findings, which have now been released, have found that there was, in fact, state capture. And the recommendations go as far as criminal actions towards those implicated and so forth. But in addition to those type of recommendations, there are also recommendations for legislation to change to protect whistleblowers. Regrettably, I think in South Africa, though, it's sort of like the wheels of justice just take a really long time to turn. So there hasn't really been like a lot of tangible changes towards whistleblowers. Except, however, this commission that came out, it was televised and it was live, right? So all the stuff and all the allegations that were made were all brought out in a formal judicial inquiry. So the people implicated really got no place to hide anymore. So that was a good thing. I think that was a win. I take it as a win.
In many countries around the world, in response to high-level whistleblowing like yours, governments often respond with legislation to either correct the deficiencies in the legal code or to strengthen the position of the whistleblower. Has that happened in your case? Has the South African government moved to clamp down on corruption or to protect whistleblowers through improved legislation?
Unfortunately not. There are no legislation changes that have been made towards whistleblowers. So all the support that whistleblowers get at the moment is like maybe from NGOs, and bizarrely not even NGOs based in South Africa, foreign NGOs. It's really regrettable, but there's absolutely no support nor protection for whistleblowers in South Africa. And I really wish that was different. And maybe in my lifetime it will change, but at the moment nothing's moved on that. There've been a few recommendations from the judicial inquiry. There's been a few really prominent members of leadership and government that have made very stern statements towards the protection of whistleblowers, but nothing has actually been communicated that it's actually even in the works have been drafted, for example. So that's quite regrettable on the whistleblower side. On the clamping down on corruption side, I mean, I've been told, I don't know this because, I mean, I don't compare legislations across countries, but apparently South Africa's got like some really good legislation, right? We've got the Public Finance Management Act. We've got so many different acts that clamp down on corruption. But the problem is it's the people that basically are empowered to actually affect that legislation. So what's been really sad is that there haven't necessarily been changes to legislation to combat it, because our legislation's pretty good. What's sadder, though, is that even with findings that there was criminal activity and that certain contracts have been taken to court and tainted as corrupt and fruitless and wasteful and so forth, no action's been taken against the accused until just recently. At the moment, the Guptas are in Bloemfontein, one of the cities in south of Joburg, for one corruption case, not even the big ones, right? Not even the ones that amount to billions. The one that they're in court for now is just for a couple of million. But it's taken a really long time to even just act against those implicated. So I think there's just a process that South Africa needs to go through. I think we need to use the good legislation that we have to hold those who are guilty to account. And then I think we need to maybe reconsider our legislations, which there's been no word on. And then it would be great to also protect whistleblowers. So there just really hasn't been a lot of action, and it's quite disheartening.
I'm very interested to know what the public reaction was to your whistleblowing. Clearly, we would expect you to be celebrated. You provided an important public service. You should be honored with awards and flattering press coverage. But I'm guessing that none of that happened. Tell us about the public reaction to your testimony and to your later release of additional documents.
But bizarrely, it actually was quite positive. So if you sort of looked at your average citizen, and my barometer for that is the feedback that my parents received, for example, that was all very positive. So there was a lot of praise. There was a lot of, you're very brave, you're a hero. There was a lot of accolades to that extent from just the general public. From anybody in position of leadership, no. That's maybe a bit sad. But listen, I mean, I didn't do what I did to get praise or anything like that. And of course, there was a significant faction that obviously was a smear campaign, right? There were people that said that I had all these hidden agendas, that I was a disgruntled employee, that I was in it for the money, that I must have been complicit, that I'm just covering my, .. there were a lot of people that were very speculative, that were quite nasty. But I mean, you can manage that. You just delete Twitter, and you just don't read the news. So there probably was a lot more than I saw. I just chose not to sort of focus on the negative stuff. I know my parents saw some of it. My ex-husband read all of it. But overall, the consistent message, now that it's been a couple of years later, has been that my efforts were appreciated and valued. And that's just sort of like from the general sort of population. So for example, my neighbors think that I'm awesome, people in industry, people in leadership positions in politics haven't quite got the same response from them though, but that's okay.
Blowing the whistle has taken a heavy toll on you, like it does with many whistleblowers. You found a new job after leaving Trillion, but you had to move on after going public. In an interview in 2021, you said becoming a whistleblower had led to the end of your marriage and had made you virtually unemployable, forcing you to rely on your elderly parents to survive. I'm truly sorry to hear that. But despite the costs of your actions, you said in 2017 that you did not regret going public. If anything, you said, you should have come forward earlier. Why do you feel that way, having paid such an enormous cost?
I mean, I was a bit naive, I guess, when I did blow the whistle, because I didn't anticipate that people that I loved would respond the way that they did. I didn't anticipate not being employable. I mean, it just confuses me now, because my skill set has not changed in any way. So my ability to add value to an organization hasn't changed. And yet finding a job is the most impossible thing. It's like trying to find the pot of gold at the end of a rainbow. It's impossible, I didn't sort of foresee these consequences when I did blow the whistle. I'll do it again, I guess. I mean, if I knew what I know now, I would maybe try and be a little bit more calculated about it. But still, when I think about it, I wouldn't have been that person that got the laptop stolen out of my car, because my evidence carries more weight with me standing behind it And me being able to write an affidavit and say, this is what happened, and say that this is the person that gave me the instruction and so forth. You know, so I would do it again because I do love this country very much. I don't want to leave South Africa. I don't want to be like one of these people exiting and, you know, don't want to go live in Australia or Canada or anything like that. No offense to any of those places, but, you know, I really love living here. And I think South Africa's got a lot to offer. I love that my daughter loves this country and was born here. All my family are here. I want to stay here and I want to see this country thrive. When you consider South Africa and the commodities that we have and the potential that we have, there's no reason why we shouldn't be a first world country. And I'd like to sort of help towards that in a little bit, in whichever way I can. And if that means ending corruption so that resources go to places where they need to go, then I'll do that. Yeah, the consequences have been regrettable. But I mean, what else do you do? I can tell you this. There's no way that I could have lived with this on my conscience. I couldn't do that. That wasn't even an option.
Bianca Goodson, thank you so much for joining us. Corruption is a cancer. A cancer that eats away at a citizen's faith in democracy. It diminishes the instinct for innovation and creativity. It squeezes already tight national budgets, crowding out important national investments. It wastes the talent of entire generations. It scares away investments and jobs. That's why we need whistleblowers. Thanks for joining us for another episode of The Whistleblowers. I'm John Kiriakou, and we'll see you next time.